Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and of course, on our podcast. I'm Ailey Packham and we are in your ears, thanks to OldFootballShirts.com. Well then, another week and another where we should probably be feeling just a little bit happier. First, we took the sting out of the bees as Jack Hinchelwood's winner saw Brentford go home with nothing. And then on Saturday, we felt the burn as a goalkeeping masterclass from James Trafford saw Burnley pick up a valuable point. We've now scored in 32 successive league fixtures. However, we've now conceded in the last 20. On Sunday, we have a chance to rectify that as we visit Arsenal. But first comes a very small matter of Marseille visiting the Amex on Thursday. We go into the game knowing that we've already qualified, but also knowing that a victory would see us top the group and therefore avoid a playoff that would give us 2 weeks off in February. All to play for then. So joining me today as we look back on all of that and look forward to Thursday is of course Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome back French football expert and Albion fan Jeremy Smith. Welcome back, Jeremy. Lovely to see you.
Thanks for having me back.
So last time we spoke, you were about to go and sit on your hands in Marseille.
Yeah.
Last time we spoke, we didn't. And I'm blaming Virgin Media. Yes, other terrible service providers are out there, but yeah, Virgin Media and my Wi-Fi can't tell. So I'm hoping for my first proper full show with Jeremy today. So yes, welcome back. So what do you mean you had to sit on your hands? Were you in the, I'll say the Marseille end? I mean, let's face it, the non-Albion end, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I was actually sort of up in the heavens a few rows behind Johnny Cantor and the commentary crew. So I wasn't sort of right in the thick of it. So I didn't feel in any immediate danger, but yeah, I was pretty pleased with the restraint that I showed with the 88th minute equaliser.
I mean, seeing as you were in amongst the crowd that night, what was their take on it? I mean, since that game, we've had the social media thing, and we can come to that. But what was the view at the time on the night?
I think that was sort of not mid Marseille crisis. There's always a Marseille crisis not far away, but that was sort of, I think it was maybe Gattuso's second game in charge. Generally, I think there was a sort of not feel good feeling, but still sort of willing to him to give him
new manager bounce
a chance. Yeah, and obviously, like the first half went extremely well for them. So I think there was definitely frustration at their end that they didn't hold on to the lead. But and I think at the time it only gave them 2 points. I think maybe they drew their first match with Ajax, but considering they were sort of coming off the back of pretty bad league form, I don't think they were too upset. I think as we discussed last time, although obviously we don't have any sort of European history, just the fact that we did very well in the Premier League last year meant that I think Marseille were a little bit scared of us. So I don't know if they'd have taken a draw beforehand, seeing as they're a kind of supposed to be a big force, especially at home, but I don't think they were too upset, just a bit frustrated to have given away a 2-goal lead.
Yeah, exactly. Well, 2-0 up at home in Europe, you for a side like Marseille, you would expect to at least hold out.
Well, I was going to say that, actually. I mean, reading a lot of comments, I kind of have a feeling, and I don't know if this is something you can pick up on, Jeremy, is that I suppose that once you're a supporter of a given country's top club, or one of the top three or four clubs, that there is a certain level of entitlement. And I'm looking at, you know, the huge amount of entitlement a lot of fans here as part of the Big Six have, to the point that, you know, they were basically accusing the referee of cheating and that, they, you know, he gave the game to us. Is that something that sort of, one, is there that level of entitlement that you feel across the OM fans? And two, is that something you picked up on?
There's definitely an element of that in the in the league, but I think because France have got such an inferiority complex in Europe, and especially compared to whenever they look at the Premier League, I think it's a little bit different. But yeah, I mean, the coverage was, there was a lot about how we should have been down to 10 men, that Lamptey should have been sent off at one point. But at the same time, I thought, there was nothing about, you know, that dunk block, for example. So, yeah, I mean, the coverage in an Ekip is always a little bit biased, especially when it's PSG or Marseille. I wouldn't say it's the same for all the clubs. And when you look at their player rankings, they're always a little bit bizarre. But I think generally we came away, you know, the first half performance, I think probably most people would have been thinking, what's all the fuss about? You know, this team everyone's been raving about for the last year or 18 months. But I think we gave a really good account of ourselves in the second half. And although I think people thought Marseille just about edged it, and as I said, the frustration about the non-standing off in their eyes, I think most people felt that it was probably more or less a fair result.
But it's a game where we felt, and we've spoken about this before, haven't we, Al, about the fact that we really kind of felt that we came of age in Europe in that game. That coming, not just after halftime, but that last 10-minute spell going into halftime where we actually woke up and actually, we're still in this game. We've got a chance.
Well, there was. We'd lost the first game and we were 2-0 down. And I think it was sort of a certain level of reality hit. Thinking, hang on, we're 1.5 games into this. You know, effectively a quarter of the way through their great European adventure. And we've got nothing to show for it. So I think there was a sort of a bit of an awakening, a sort of a bit of a realisation. I wouldn't say Marseille exactly folded. I think it's when the Albion do click, I think it's actually very, very difficult for any side, as we've seen in bits and pieces, and even in the two league games we're about to discuss. Once we click, it's difficult to stop us. And certainly, like you say, in the last 5-10 minutes of that first half, and then for a lot of that second half, I think you know, a lot of people finally got to see what we were about. We had bits and pieces of it in AEK, but against AEK at the Amex. But, you know, we got a couple of moody, well, not moody, there were proper penalties, but even then they were so low-key almost that the referee didn't give them, and, you know, and it had to be VAR that stepped in. So, yes, we haven't looked back since then.
You've spoken before about, I think, how we sort of played the occasion more than the opponents. And yeah. I thought, especially for those first sort of three halves of the campaign, right, the whole of the first match against Athens, and the first half against Marseille, there was an element of that. But also, I thought we were a little bit physically bullied in those two. And
yeah.
I don't want to be sort of too stereotypical. I don't know if it's expected a little bit of Athens, but you don't necessarily expect that of Marseille. And you certainly don't expect Veretout to be sort of rampaging down the wing kind of thing, which he's, you know, he's just a workhorse central midfielder. So yeah, I think there really was a wake-up call, like, we're, you know, we're better than this and they're not as good as we're sort of giving them credit for with our performance so far.
And I think,
well, if you look back to the Athens game a couple of weeks ago, even then, I mean, AEK were very, very good, they were very strong, and they were certainly not there to make up the numbers. I think that against the two games against Ajax, and particularly obviously again the second half against Marseille, we were given a chance, and I think it's going to be a very open game again come Thursday night.
I think Ajax are certainly a lot better than their 4 points would ever say, but you know, you've still got to sort of do the business, you've still got to you know, get it right, and Marseille have shown that actually probably they are getting stronger. They're probably going to be a better side than certainly the team that we played in the second half at the Velodrome. I think our real coming of age wasn't even necessarily at the Amex against Ajax, because that was the home game we won. It was actually the fact that we went to the Johan Cruyff Arena and beat Ajax on their own doorstep, in their own backyard. That's when I'm thinking, okay, guys, you can do this. You know, you just have to be the team that you know you have been for the past year, and I say, as Jeremy said, the year 18 months. So, yeah, the AEK game and the first half of the Marseille game, yeah, the second half, you know, silenced the crowd. And I think that gave everyone a lift for the AEK game at the Amex and then the game at the Johan Cruyff Arena. We didn't exactly boss it, but we stood tall. And I think that's what gave us... I would actually go so far as to say it's probably what got us through the AEK game in Athens, because, again, we weren't good.
Yeah, I think... need to maybe see a little bit more of that in the league, but you know, that it was nice to see us winning a game where we weren't necessarily playing well. We were doing it more sort of through force of will than anything else. I think to an extent we're sort of running on fumes at the moment, and it's about sort of getting it done. However you need to do that. And okay, it was a penalty. I don't think it was a soft penalty. I think it was relatively clear cut. And then I'd say we were sort of holding on for a lot of the first half against Dyke, but the second half I thought was pretty even. And obviously the game opens up after a goal, but we had chances to score more. It wasn't just us sort of the Alamo kind of all of their attack against us, just last-ditch defending or anything.
I mean,
like
Ferguson
that.
Had two massive chances in that game, which would have made it a lot more comfortable. And like,
as did Duffus.
Yeah, indeed, absolutely. Yeah.
Jeremy, looking forward to this Thursday, how have the two teams, obviously you're looking out for them, how have the two teams changed since that second game at the Velodrome?
I'd probably say that Brighton are a little bit, if you take away the European side, we're just talking about league form, I think Brighton, although we're still kind of in a great place, and we'll talk about it later, but the frustration that, you know, we could have been fifth after the Burnley match, we're still right up there. It feels like we're not close to our really best form, I don't think, in the league. And because of the injuries, because of the sort of quick turnaround of matches, it feels like sort of one match on, one match a little bit off, or sort of recovering from Europe, or maybe half thinking of Europe as the next European match. And so we're not really, you know, had a quick look. We haven't had two straight wins since, I think, September. And we're not really sort of clicking into, you know, a run of really good form, I don't think. Whereas Marseille in recent weeks really has hit good form.
What
you have to consider, though, is we'll talk about the number of changes and everything else that we've made this season a little bit later on. But the fact that we've got so many injuries and we haven't been able to probably put out our first choice team pretty much since September. It's just been a catalogue, and the fact that we're actually just ticking over. I mean, I think we're actually, fortunately, with Christmas, normally you're playing a load of games, but we're actually only playing a couple of teams. So we're going to have a chance to get some players back. So hopefully get through this game on Thursday, and then come February or March, depending on when we're playing, then, you know, we'll have the likes of Onsizo back. We'll have Danny Welbeck back. We're not going to get Solly back, unfortunately, but we'll have Fatty back. You know, these are big players for us this season, and, you know, we're going to need them going forwards.
But these are just reasons for us to look out for how well our team is doing. This is something that Marseille are not going to give a flying toss about, nor are Arsenal on Sunday. I mean, there does seem to be a sort of plethora of injuries in the Premier League at the moment, and there's a few teams on double-digit injuries at the moment. It's bizarre. No idea what it's all about. But, you know, if you're going to compare against, you know, the game at the Velodrome, we're probably in a not dissimilar position, as much as we probably still had a few injuries then. We're putting out a scratch team now, which in itself is actually still functioning. Let's put it that way.
It's not a criticism. Just, you know, there's definite reasons for it.
Sure.
Yeah, Jeremy, if you look at the league records, though, between both, if you compare Brighton and Marseille currently, they played 20, they've got 23 points from 15 games. Albion, they've got 26 from 16 games. So pretty similar, really.
Yeah. I mean, you can argue about sort of the sort of standard of opposition, and Premier League maybe is a little bit harder sort of week in, week out. But, you do sort of begrudgingly have to give Marseille a little bit of credit for the way that they did overcome a sort of big crisis at the start of the season, and recently you're in very good form.
So given that, we'll move on from this in a sec, but last question about this. So given that Marseille only need a draw in order to top the group and have that same 2 weeks off in February versus the Albion needing a win, how do you think have you heard about how Marseille are going to approach the game on Thursday?
I think they'd approach it pretty seriously. I mean, yeah, the pressure's off in a way to an extent for both teams, but there's always more pressure. I think, you know, arguably a playoff round would be nice for us in that it's another trip abroad, but as we've seen, because of the injuries and the turnaround of games, I think we'd all prefer just to go straight through, and obviously better chance of going further because in theory we're playing supposedly a stronger team who are given a second chance. But I think Marseille want to top the group. They've only got a couple more matches until the winter break. They're not the toughest of matches. So I think in a way this is their toughest match till sort of mid-January now. So they should go all out, I think.
Yeah. This is the bit where the tournament gets a little bit silly, a little bit stupid in my view. I mean, your reward for failure, ladies and gentlemen. You go into a competition, you've got a better chance of winning. Which is absolutely ridiculous. So we're looking at we're recording this on Tuesday, so the games on Tuesday night and Wednesday night, we're looking at who's going to be finishing third, and there is one team there I do not want to play, and we all know why.
Galatasaray.
Oh, can you just imagine Tiny Tears? Can you?
Well, let's not worry about it right now.
Oh, God, I'm shuddering thinking about it. So, come on, do whatever you need to finish second or bottom, Gala.
I mean, there's a few other teams I'd quite like to avoid there as well.
Well, exactly. Well, we know that all we know is that we're going to avoid the English teams. That's all we know.
Yeah. Braga. We can go to Braga.
Braga's great. I've been to that ground. It's the one that's in the quarry.
It is. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's probably the coldest state, one of the coldest stadiums I've ever been to in the height of a heat wave in Portugal.
Mm.
It's that bizarre.
Now, Jeremy, obviously we're playing Arsenal at the weekend, and one player who had a bit of a weird time at Arsenal was Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. He seems to be in the goals for Marseille at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I know he did some good stuff at Arsenal, a couple of maybe FA Cup final winners, that kind of thing, but certainly left under a cloud. And I was going to say didn't do much at Barcelona, but I actually listened to another podcast today when someone was saying his time there is actually underrated. But he looked a busted flush by the time he got to Marseille. And although he scored a couple of Europa goals, he'd done nothing in the league until recently. And then in the last four matches, he's just exploded. I think he's got like seven goals and a few assists as well. So I guess he's sort of one of those strikers who, you know, hits purple patches and becomes more confident. There's a few penalties in there, but we're not begrudging João Pedro them. So no, exactly. I guess we should do the same for him. So he's a bit of a concern, but again, possibly against the speed and physicality of an English team, which isn't the same as even a Lyon and Rennes, who are both struggling a lot this year, for example. Hopefully it'll be a different story.
Yeah, you mentioned Verratti earlier on, and he seems to be a player that's been rated very, very highly by London.
He was actually in the world, the under 17, under 20 World Cup squad, the team that won the World Cup with like Pogba and people like that in 2013. And obviously didn't quite go on to hit the heights that they did. But I think he was very well thought of in Rome, where he played for a while. He has had a couple of French internationals now, international caps. And like I said, I mean, he's not the most exciting player in the world, but he's a very solid central midfielder. And Marseille have actually got a lot of them, like him, Rangier, Unai, who had a really good World Cup, but hasn't done that much since. So whoever they play there is going to be, you know, is going to be a bit of a battle in there, I think. But he's not really the most creative of players. He's a good penalty taker, but they're not really looking to him. He's not a classic number 10. And that's what was a little bit shocking in the first half at the Velodrome, that we allowed him to somehow be dictating the match. And he's not that type of player.
Okay. Well, we've got a lot to look forward to. And obviously we'll come back to that one next week, hopefully talking about our game in March and not in February. But first, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. Online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. And as ever, in association with OldFootballShirts.com. Now, Phil's given us a nice little yellow and green shirt to have a look at this week. So, Jeremy, can you have a go at describing this little number for me?
Yeah, it's mainly yellow with sort of thin green stripes coming down. It's the V-neck collar, which is mostly green, and the sleeves are mostly green as well, but with a little kind of trim of that yellow with the pencil green stripes.
That material doesn't look nice, does it?
No, I was going to say it's a very shiny material. Spal of the manufacturers, and the sponsor is Holland Decorators. I don't know if it's just the photo I'm looking at, but it doesn't look like the sponsor's been put on there very straight.
No, it doesn't, does it? And no, I'm not sure that Holland Decorators spent any time on their logo either.
They certainly didn't. It is
now the trick here is to see if you can zoom in on the badge. But one thing that this is this picture is small, and it's one of those badges that's not a kind of a graphic like say the Albion's is. It's a kind of a coat of arms where, you know, it's a tradition of football clubs had coats of arms for badges. And I can't work it out apart from possibly guessing it might be, say, Leighton Orient. I'm going to guess the year as well.
Yeah.
As being 89-90, just because I think that's about the time we had our Spal kit. But as for the badge, I'm guessing Leighton Orient, with that being a bit of a stab in the dark.
No, it is later than that, actually. And this is what Phil has to say about this lovely shirt. Actually, did you want to... Oh, we know it's English, don't we? And so I'm...
Jeremy has quite... a guess, actually, as to who it is, though.
Oh, yeah, do you want to have a guess?
Yeah, I mean, looking at the coat of arms, I don't know why. The only team that I'm thinking, and I might be completely wrong, and it's not a coat of arms, is Wigan, but it's very much not Wigan colours. So, yeah, I'm lost. I don't know this one.
I think Wigan have had a shirt in those sort of colours. I mean, it's very similar to a West Brom shirt, isn't it?
But, yeah.
Away shirt from back in the day.
But it's
not them either. Now, this is what Phil has to say about this particular jersey, and he's chosen it for no particular reasons, but he does say you can't bink a pink and orange kit. Let's leave that one hanging. This is the 1995-96 away shirt of Halifax Town AFC. Nicknamed the Shaman, the team was formed in 1911 and was dissolved in 2008 for financial reasons whilst playing in the conference. Home was the Shay, which had a capacity of 14,000. Also in 2008, a new team was formed in Halifax called FC Halifax Town, also nicknamed the Shaman, and also playing at the Shay Stadium, capacity 14,000. This team began life in the Northern Premier League Division North, which is the eighth tier of English football, and they progressed over the years to be currently sitting ninth in the National League. Notable former Halifax Town AFC players include Phil Brown, who played 135 times for the Shaman before moving to Bolton in 1988, where he played 256 times. Former Portsmouth, Newcastle and Southampton left-back John Beresford played his last season in 2002 at Halifax. Neil Redfern played over 850 games during his long career, 42 of them for Halifax. And for a standout former FC Halifax player, you can look no further than Jamie Vardy, who started his senior career in 2010 at Halifax. A brief stint at Fleetwood followed before his move to Leicester. Links to the Albion are plentiful and offer the full gamut of good, the bad, and quite possibly ugly too. I'll let our listeners decide which one might be which. Frank Worthington finished his career as player coach with Halifax. Midfielder Lamy Robertson came to the Goldstone from the Shay in 1973. Dave Cameron infuriated Mickey Adams and the Brighton fans in 1999. He went on to play for six teams with Team 2000 and 2003 before ending up at Halifax. Alex South defended for us between 49 and 54. He spent 10 seasons with Halifax before retiring in 65. Jimmy Case was sublime for us in the 80s and was a stalwart for us in the 90s. He also played at Halifax in 92-93. The list goes on. Jason Peake, Andy Crosby, Mark Cartwright, Willie Irvine, Kieran O'Regan and Chris Wilder, amongst others, all played for both sides. And back up to date, Carl Rushworth, who is currently on loan at Swansea, and the future Albion number one, says Phil, began his career as a youth team player at FC Halifax.
Can I actually also throw in there? I mean, I'm glad that you mentioned Chris Wilder. I could be wrong, but I think that this is the case that Bobby Zamora scored arguably his best goal for the Albion against Halifax when the ball was played up. Chris Wilder was the right back playing for them. And he absolutely skied a clearance, which fell at the feet of Bobby Zamora. He volleyed it first time into the bottom corner.
the goal known as the Van Basten goal.
That's the kiddie, was it? Okay, fair enough. I still think he shanked it. but it went in. And yes, I think that was... And I think there was also a game, and I don't think it was that one. There was also a game with Dean against Halifax where the referee was so bad. I think he sent Gary Hart off. He was so bad that the manager, and this is must have been very, very early days because he moved off to the right from where I was sitting in the south stand back towards his porter cabin as opposed to the later years when it was at the far end on the left. He ended up watching the last 10 minutes of the game from behind the goal because he was so fed up with the referee's performance, as was the Albion manager's one. And I don't know if you remember this game. I think we won 2-1. Do you remember? I suppose rubbish referees just blend into each other, don't they?
I know what you're trying to segue into there. But of course, you can see that this shirt and over 130,000 others over at oldfootballshirts.com. And actually, Phil has got a delightful shirt over on eBay at the moment as well, which is the 91 Sports Express Novo kit, which is the original Tesco bag. I love
it. My favourite.
But yeah, cool. So anyway, so Al, you were talking about referees there. You just wanted to have a quick chat about Turkey, of all places.
Well, let's say, I mean, I'm not...
Very appropriate for this time of year.
Yes. I'm not going to try and pronounce the referee's game, but last night, as per when we were recording this, there was a match in the Super League, which is the top division of Turkish football, and the game finished 1-1, and the players are probably having their usual sort of argument on argy-bargy because, you know, let's not stereotype, there's a lot of hotheads out there. And with that, the club president came on and absolutely lamped the referee. He gave him a black eye, and someone else then sort of literally stuck the boot in. There was a couple of other people who have since been arrested. Now, this actually then sort of, when I saw this, the first thing I thought, well, the second thing I thought, the first thing I thought was, I hope the referee's okay. The second thing I thought is this the culmination of the fact that referees seem to be pariahs, that we have spent so much time criticising them? There's open season on them, not now just verbally, but physically. Now, obviously, there is the whole consideration of the vast, vast, vast majority of people, to the point of almost everyone, maybe even everyone, recognises the difference between verbal criticism or even verbal abuse of referee, and that then segueing into violence. Albeit, we've now shown that that leap has now been made. So this is a radio program of opinions, and we give opinions on how a player played, how we thought the manager did, and sometimes how the referee did. And ironically, the last two games at the Amex, I wouldn't comment on the referee at all because, like they say, the best referees are the ones you don't notice. I thought that, you know, they made the decisions, and I couldn't, you know, sort of have too many issues about them. You just think, well, okay, maybe he could have done that, maybe, but no, that was fine. They arbitrate the game as best they can. And it actually sort of just gave me pause for thought as someone who's done this for so long as to, have I actually crossed that line when I'm thinking I'm fairly criticising a referee? Am I going too far? And it's actually just given me pause for thought. And Jeremy, as a writer, I was just wondering, have you, or do you know of anyone else who actually has, even without sort of realising it, made their critique? And that critique is just that sort of 1/8.
I think there's always been, I mean, I haven't seen it in any sort of formal writing or, you know, match reviews or anything like that, however one-sided they might be. But, you know, certainly I've got carried away on Twitter when I should know better, and other people do that as well. And you know, you could even, just thinking of that, the PSG Newcastle match a couple of weeks ago, where, you know, Shearer was pretty rude about the referee, even though he was happy to sort of joke about how bad, you know, the bad refereeing decisions that that were made against Arsenal in the Newcastle match. So, you know, I'm not saying that it always evens out, but referees, I think, you know, more than 99 times out of 100 are just trying to do their job. They're human, they make mistakes. VAR is supposed to cut that out, and obviously that's a big different debate. But I think, you know, if you go into the job of refereeing, you know you're going to get some abuse. But as you said, verbal abuse, or, you know, banned, though, you know, abuse shouldn't go too far either, but it certainly shouldn't go into the physical side. And I think I guess writers and pundits and former players do have a responsibility themselves not to go too far and not to stoke the fire.
Cast us into that as well. Now, I'm not saying that our influence is particularly strong, far from it. But, you know, if we are going to be part of that narrative that's actually just going to continually stick the boot into referees, then we've actually got to look at ourselves as well, I think.
I think, I mean, they're not fair game. They're part of the tableau which we go to watch every weekend, and you know, and they, you know, if a player makes a mistake, you know, we might control it or kick it harder or something stupid. But it's like the ref, you know, it's a very difficult situation. They're out there on their own. Obviously, they've got the linesman as well, and now they've got VAR. But I actually think it was worse. I think it's actually got worse since VAR has actually come in, because it's just accentuated a bad decision, which all refs will make during a game. It's, you know, it happens. But at the end of the day, we do probably have a pile in a couple of times, because we feel that there has been a few instances where if a referee makes a decision on the pitch and it's wrong and there is no VAR, then fine. You move on. There's not much you can do about it. But the fact that the VAR is there, and we've seen it go wrong so badly, the Spurs game, the Palace goal where they draw the line in the wrong place, the Everton game where they drew the line in the wrong place, it's not open season on the rest, but basically they're not being helped by their colleagues. They're trying to help. You know, there was that thing that Mike Dean said, go, oh, I was helping my mate. Don't help your mate. Make the right decision.
Well, there's that, but I mean, that sounds as though that kind of mitigates, not necessarily criticism, but even the next stage on, which is abuse. I mean, when it comes to, for instance, that Palace game, it's not as though we're going to call the referee or the linesman several kinds of whatever it is you want to call him. It's just a case of, okay, you got it wrong, but, you know, why did you get it wrong? Get it right. The Spurs game, I mean, that's still a head shaker. And when you've got the head of the referees coming by and saying sorry, but that doesn't mitigate the next level. That's, you know, because what happens is that I think that there's the referees being human. I think actually there's something else that I think that really would help. And again, it's not as though we can actually necessarily equate ourselves as being on the same level with Alan Shearer or Gary Lineker or Ian Wright or anything like that. But we are out there as sort of, you know, broadcast critiques, and I'll say this about anyone who works on a newspaper, whether it's local, whether it's online, whether it's national, anyone who makes this, is that I think they're helping, that actually understanding the laws of the game will actually help people make a better critique. Let's put it this way. I'll just give you one quick example. At the end of the Chelsea game, instead of giving a corner to the Albion, gave a drop ball to Chelsea after the penalty was overturned. I can't remember. But the point is that so many people are going, what's going on? Well, if you knew the laws of the game, then you'd know what was going on. And that's the point. A lot of it is that I think some people still operate their knowledge on the laws of the game from stuff that's 10, 15 years old. So that will help us.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that, you know, you got to trust them to know the rules of the game probably better than us. But That's the kind of example where it is, you know, a little subtlety or whatever. Examples like the Spurs match last year, they were just outrageous errors. And I do think referees, I mean, again, it just comes to being human. I do think they're sort of unconsciously biased to the bigger teams, because you make a mistake against Brighton, it might get a couple of headlines the next day. You make a mistake against United or Chelsea or something, it's going to be in the headlines for the whole of the following week. So again, I think like the whole football community, I guess, has a responsibility to make their job a little bit easier and reduce the pressure under which they're working.
It doesn't help when you've got like actual people who are in like at the forefront of this, like Jose Mourinho, who's like assaulting referees in car parks.
Well, that sort of thing's never going to happen. Like I say, there's the line that's crossed. Like I say, we'd like to think in what we're doing is that we're offering up a critique. Yeah, we're annoyed, and yes, we're biased about it. We make no bones about it.
Are we biased?
Well, of course we are. But my point would be is that there is a huge leap. I actually thought it was a huge leap between what we're doing and the next person coming on and absolutely clattering a referee. You think maybe it happens once in a while at a Sunday League football. Now, I also like to think it's not going to happen in the Premier League. You'd be appalled if it did. Let's put it this way. If England did what Turkey is correctly doing, in my opinion, which is indefinitely suspending the games until such time as actually basically everyone sorts themselves out, then, you know, if it was to happen in England, that would have even bigger repercussions just because of the stature of the game here.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think it's just, for me, when I saw the incident this morning, it's not as though we're putting ourselves on a pedestal to say that we're influencers any way. Of course we're not.
No.
But it also does actually make me think, well, if we're actually going to say anything, if we're going to...
I think you're thinking
too
much about it, Al, to be honest.
Sorry?
I think you're thinking too much about it. I mean, it's a bad incident.
We don't
let's hope it's not the tip of the iceberg, but it stands as a warning that this could happen, and let's make sure that it doesn't. I think this will be the... We've got to move on, because we need to talk about Jack. And as his uncle once said, it's not a big name, just a long one. And it's like Jack Hinshelwood, Jeremy, playing out of position. He's been given an opportunity and he's doing brilliantly, right?
As you said, I mean, even, you know, his first match against Villa, I was like, not exactly an easy debut to have. So I think he's shown character already just to bounce back from that. Then to be playing out of position as a, you know, completely new sort of professional or new to the first team is tough enough, but to be playing so well and yeah, the Brentford performance was just superb. And it wasn't just the goal, which was a brilliant header. It was, he had a big part to play in the first goal. He had a clearance off the line. He was just fantastic all round. And, you know, arguably it's slightly unlucky that Gross had such a good game as well, but they sort of shared all the credit between them.
But I mean, we were talking earlier about the situation we find ourselves in. Well, yeah, but you said that we've got no fullbacks, and you know, it's given these kids an opportunity because.
Well, you say kids, you mean James Milner?
Well, yeah, he's a kid. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, picking up on Jeremy's point, I actually thought that if central midfield is his place, then absolutely, you know, eventually I'm sure he'll work his way back there. Oddly enough, that's probably. I'm really going to blow it now. That's the place where actually we've got enough for the time being cover. It's everywhere else that we haven't. He actually looks quite at home at right back. And under other circumstances, and I know we've had this sort of running joke, AD, about, right, everyone that breaks into the team, first thing that they're going to do is play at right back before they can play anywhere else. And I'm including you goalkeepers. He actually looks quite at home at right back. Now, when he came on, and I think it might have been against Forest, or it might have even been a game before that. I can't remember exactly, because 6 games ago is obviously a long time. He looked like a rabbit in the headlights and didn't know what he was doing. Somewhere down the line, he's had a conversation with Lewis Dunk, with Roberto Di Zerbi, with Pascal Gross, with the seniors to say, I'm scared, what do I do? And they've told him what to do, and he's gone and done it. And he looks so at home, and if we're going to sort of talk about the Brentford and Burnley games as sort of like one big blur, again, I thought it was another coming of age of the Burnley game. He was absolutely fantastic and looked so at home. So in the great scheme of things right now, 6 games into his professional career or whatever it is, and 18 years old, with his salmon-like qualities as well.
Actually, that was what I was going to talk about, because that's incredible. He's about 2 foot nothing, and he's like... He's
5'10"
height, doesn't he?
He has actually 5'10", but
is he?
Yeah,
I would never have guessed that.
Yeah, he's not a midget, believe me. I'll tell you what makes him look short is because he wears his socks around his ankles, and only short people ever did that, apart from Glenn Hoddle.
Jack came in against Brentford, Jeremy, and that was another change. 6 changes against Brentford. That made it 67 for the season, which
who's
is
counted?
Some 23 more than the nearest next one, which is Nottingham Forest. That is a lot. Now, obviously, the injuries haven't helped. The constant changing of the goalkeeper is that's a bit Marmite with some people. I mean, where do you stand on the multiple changes?
I understand why a lot of it is because of the injuries and obviously just managing 2 matches a week, which is very new to us. For me, it's more the goalkeeper and the defence, which is a little bit, I'm a little bit less comfortable with. I think if you don't need to change them, don't. I think they're so important in terms of foundations. I mean, I like both keepers. I don't mind which one it is, but I suppose I'm going to contradict myself. I'd say I think it's important for a keeper and a defence to keep working as a unit. But I guess if the defence can't even remain as a unit, you know, the same four players week in, week out, then it doesn't really matter who's behind them.
Would you say that's part of the reason why that we haven't actually had a clean sheet in the league this season?
I think it's got to be. But at the same time, I was thinking about it today. I think it's hard to say that any of our defence or defenders have had particularly, I don't think any of them have had bad seasons. Arguably, Dunk isn't quite at the same extremely brilliant levels of last year, but he's still playing extremely well. Van Heek, I think, has gone up a level and has been fantastic. Igor, I think, is growing into the role more and more. There's the issues of the fullback, but everyone that comes in, I think, is still doing a good job. So it's kind of, it's, I don't understand. I mean, I know it's, you know, partly just because of the expansive way we play, but it's just bizarre that we've gone, whatever it is, 20, 21 games conceding.
I think there's also the notion of the goals that we concede at set pieces. Now, again, morphing the two games together, Burnley's goal was certainly an open, was open play, and Brentford's was a absolutely ridiculous penalty, and neither of which were particularly good defending. But if you rewind a couple of games, the City goals that we conceded against Chelsea, that wasn't necessarily down to the defenders per se. People saying, oh, if Lewis Dunk was on the pitch, we wouldn't have conceded them. Well, to my mind, Lewis Dunk would have been the fella who was chasing the person who was headed it back. That leaves the others, and that means midfielders and forwards, to do their job. And I think the critique that De Zerbi has given, certainly on those two goals, that there are certain people who are not defenders who weren't doing their job properly. And they must learn to do that, and they must up their game from doing that. And since then, all right, we haven't conceded from a set piece. Fine, great. But, you know, you can't actually pick up every single mistake and just learn it one at a time. It's got to be learned as a whole. You know, when we played Burnley, they got their one shot away, and that was that.
They had a few, to be honest, they had a few other efforts, actually, Burnley. I mean, they had the early sighter, which was an early warning sign that they were going to come in, and they were probably going to try and, like, catch us out and shoot on the from distance. And they had another chance where they should have probably scored, where the fella was, like, sliding in the second half.
Maybe, but, you know, it's...
You had there was the opportunity where unnamed striker nearly scored.
Well, quite. So, yeah, it is a funny one that we've got this ridiculous thing, and it's not as though anyone's playing badly per se. But I think that getting back to the other point about the number of changes, I mean, let's say what's in a number, like say of that, probably 10 of those 67 is down to the goalkeeper. Personally, guns ahead, I'd rather Jason Steele stayed in goal. I think he just, for me, gets the nod over Verbruggen, although I've got no problem mostly with Verbruggen playing. But yeah, it's for all the preparations that the club made, and we're talking about all the way back to February and March here, of realizing we might get into Europe, we've got plan A, B, C, and D, how much we're gonna have to spend, who we're gonna need, how many, you know, who's gonna play in what competition, et cetera, et cetera. The whole lot gets completely undone by the fact that we've got all these so many injuries, and there's not a huge amount. You can mitigate your squad selection partially for injuries because you know they're going to happen, but the extent to which they happen this season is absolutely ludicrous. So we're not helped by that. And the nature of De Zerbi's tactics mean that you are going at full pelt for 100 minutes. And that is a really tough ask on people who are not 100 minutes fit.
Well, I mean, you say that. I mean, that was going to be my next question. I mean, where do you stand, Jeremy, on the... On the 45-minute Lallana cameo? Because I mean I guess I'm old fashioned. I go back to the days of Brian Clough, where he said if you're fit enough to be on the bench, you're fit enough to play 90 minutes. Now obviously with the number of subs that we've got now, that obviously that does mitigate that somewhat, but it does seem to. I would rather have a player start that's going to finish. That it's just not.
I think I was going to say that I think that the higher number of substitutes now makes a big difference. You've got a couple of, you know, they're not sort of free goes, but they're certainly more than Clough would ever have had in his day, for example. And I think with all that chopping and changing and with some, you know, inexperienced people in the team, I think having Lallana there on the pitch, as well as sort of helping shout orders from the side, I think does help to an extent. But I think it's not even so much for the team. I wonder for him if it's... I don't feel like as good as he still plays and flashes, I think only 45 minutes at a time, I don't feel like he's sort of getting the chance to really sort of grab a game by the scruff of the neck and control it as much as he could do. But maybe that is all he's capable of doing nowadays. I don't know.
Well, that's what De Zerbi seems to think. But I mean, we've seen him play 90 minutes before, and I mean, if he's in the squad, then he's got to be, he should be able to play. I mean, we've seen him out during lockdown. I mean, he's such an important cog of the team and a lieutenant, even when he's not on the pitch.
You're right, the word's lieutenant. But the point is you're slightly comparing apples with oranges here. During lockdown, we had certainly for that first season, we had about, I don't know, 8-10 games to go, and they were fairly spaced apart. This time round, we're talking about games coming thick and fast, and that the whole notion of him being 90 minutes fit versus 45 minutes fit, well, clearly he's not. But as Jeremy says, his experience counts for a lot, and you'd like to then think he's going to put the momentum into game. Personally, I think he's better off coming on, better off coming off the bench and shoring up the position, either shoring up a position if we're in a winning position, or putting something else into the team if we're struggling a little bit. So, for instance, a hypothetical from the Burnley game, if we'd have had a poor first half, but Lallana wasn't playing, I wouldn't have minded him coming on for the last 20 minutes in order to have that extra oomph because of his experience.
I agree, but I think De Zerbi's had his fingers burned with that before, because basically he's brought him on and he's gone off 5 minutes later.
Well, in that case, then he's clearly not 90 minutes fit. You like to think he's 45.
He's just got history. I'm not criticizing Lallana at all, by the way. I think he's been an absolutely fabulous signing for us. But I just would like to see players start and finish at the same time. I mean, you're going to make changes. You know, you're going to have players in and out of form. Sometimes you're going to have a better game than others. But if
you've got a player that is going to struggle to play 90 minutes, then they risk the supposedly he was only 45 minutes good, and he's still on 75 minutes. The higher risk that he's got of being injured and therefore being out for longer as a result of that is not something so this is the planning, this is the puzzle that De Zerbi has to resolve himself.
Well, on that, I'd say it might be less about him and how long he can play. It's more about managing the other players. You don't want to risk someone else being overplayed. Then he's more than capable replacement or person to sort, 45 minutes top gap or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just playing devil's advocate on it, really. But one player who is playing pretty much every minute of every game is Simon Adingra, and he pops up with the equaliser on Saturday.
Personally, I think he really, really needed that. I don't know if it was obvious to the players, or I don't know even if the players would agree, but I think a lot of people that we've spoken to, certainly for the last four or five games, it's not as though there's a lack of effort. It's not as though he's not bothered, but he hasn't really contributed anything. The crosses have been poor. He's not really tried to get past his man. A shot that comes in that's awful. And it's one of those times, and it happens in a game or it happens over a period of time where nothing goes right. And I think that, we could appreciate and see his effort. So the goal that he scored against Burnley, I think hopefully might be that little bit of a bright spark that says, he can do this, where previously I thought he was a little bit of a make weight, where we're so struggling with numbers at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he's actually quite high up on the assist charts now. You'd be surprised, but not as many as Pascal.
No one's as high as Pascal, but I think this is the point. The point I'm making is that it's about the current form. We know he can do it. And I think, by and large, don't get me wrong, I think probably just out of experience, I'd much rather a fit Solly March was playing rather than Adingra. But and that would then make Adingra, wow, what a sub. Fantastic. And he can go mental for 20 minutes rather than having to, as you say, sort of work out his game time over 100 minutes as to what he's going to do.
Yeah,
honestly, I thought he looked exhausted.
Jeremy?
I'm a fan of his. And I have to say, I mean, as much as I love Mitoma when he's at the top of his game, I just feel like, you know, maybe going back to a couple of those early European matches, I feel like sometimes he, I'm not going to say bottles it, but I think sometimes he sort of plays within himself. And
I agree.
Think sometimes Adingra has a little bit more personality, a little bit more guts. Again, sort of alluding to French football, there's a big debate about Ousmane Dembele. Is he any good because he loses the ball so many times, or is he great because he's always willing to try something and that's why he loses it? I think Adingra is maybe a little bit more like that than Mitoma. And there's been, I don't know, was it the Brentford match? I'm trying to think. There was one match where it felt like everything he touched went wrong, but then he also had those couple of really good chances late on. So I can't, I don't know if, again, I'm sort of merging.
Yeah, the Brentford game, Dingley had a couple of chances to add some gloss to the scoreline. Yeah, there was one that just went narrowly wide. There was one that was like saved down at the far post. It was, he had a few chances, and maybe Al's right. Maybe you just needed one to go in, but
yeah,
he doesn't hide like you said. He doesn't hide. He always puts in the shift, and he's like,
sometimes I find it frustrating that we always go down the left, and maybe just occasionally to give the other team a bit more to think about, we could, you know, sort of alternate on the right. And that might be, again, because of who's playing fullback and the combinations between the fullback and the winger as well.
But yeah. It's injuries again, though, isn't it? Because you're missing.
But if we're looking at the Brentford game, sorry, the Burnley game, for instance, I had the charge put to me that, oh, we're a little bit one-dimensional. And I'm thinking, well, you've got this triangle of Gross, Mitoma, and for a while, I think it was Pedro. And they were sort of working the ball between them. And the reason they were doing it so much, like as Jeremy said, we were going down the left a lot, is because it was effective. Mitoma actually had probably his best half in the second half against Burnley. It's always tainted by the fact that we didn't get the winning goal. But actually, Mitoma was superb against Burnley in the second half. And he got past his man time after time after time, just couldn't find that final ball, couldn't find that, Pascal Gross is good at clipping that ball up and what have you. It was great. In the end, it was Person coming in from the right to get the equaliser. Fantastic. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter where it comes from, so long as it goes in. But
it was very, there were very Potter-esque stats on Saturday.
Go on, what have you got?
It was, well, I think it was 16 shots on goal, 9 on target, I think it was. But it was
the second half?
No, the game.
29, but, so, yeah. It's,
I mean, I saw, when I, you know, was it Trafford, the keeper?
Yeah.
It was only those two in the last minute that were really standout saves. And most of the others, I thought, were sort of, you'd expect keepers to make them.
Yeah.
We've been here before, though. I mean, goalkeepers do tend to have worldies against us, because is that to do with our finishing, or is that due to do with the goalkeeper?
Well, again, you have to bear in mind that Burnley offer very little in the second half. Yes, they had the odd chance on the breakaway here and there, and that's what they were hoping for. But apart from that, it was largely one-way traffic, and that was a very congested penalty area. And it's actually quite difficult. And I know that the likes of Chelsea in their pomp, Manchester City, Liverpool, they struggle to beat teams who are doing that. And here we are, Icklebrighton, sort of trying to break that down. Did well to get, let's put it this way, we didn't lose. The scoreboard keeps ticking over. That's
good. Right. You're right, by the way. It was 29 shots, 11 on target. I was thinking about
that. Yeah, that was the stat I'd been told.
I was looking at the Brentford game.
All right. Well, that's not bad. 45 attempts on goal in two matches and three goals scored. That's like you say, that's Potter-esque, that is. But my point is still, the contention is still that we managed to get round the back of them. We got the ball in. And it's difficult to get it past this brick wall. And Burnley, yes, they did very well. We didn't help ourselves by some poor finishing. Yes, the keeper did well as well. I think that the main save that people are talking about is the one from Mitoma. He really caught it well. It went smack into the ground, but it was going to go flying over him, and the keeper did well. Hinshelwood had a couple of, well, he was going to score a carbon copy of the goal, the one he got against Brentford.
Well, actually, the goal that Adingra did score was a carbon copy of that. It was identical.
But Hinshelwood was about to do the same as well. And then there was a bit where the ball came to the back. Adingra gets to the byline, sort of hooks it back. And when I say about Hinshaw and his fish-like qualities, I mean, we're talking about a salmon that was bent in half. Really got a good bullet header on it. Keeper made, yes, a save he probably should have done. But, you know, I think that getting back to the thing that you said 20 minutes ago, we have got a real gem on our hands here. Another one off the production line. Yes, his form will dip. Yes, he will. He's still going to find his feet. But at the moment, I think he's the confidence that's grown within him makes me less worried for, at the moment, for right back. And let's face it, Joel Veltman can come back in a heartbeat, can't he?
Indeed. And it's nearly January as well, just in case we did need something else. and we might. I mean, Jeremy, I mean, it's you looking, you think we'll strengthen come January?
I think I can only see it being fullbacks, but I think we do need a bit more cover there. Sort of not, I was going to say proper fullbacks. I mean, people that are fullbacks by sort of profession. And there's often rumours about, is it Boca Juniors?
Oh, yeah, Basso.
Yeah, I know he's ginger. I can't remember.
Yeah, Basso. Yeah. A Bacho, probably, but.
Isn't there a Romanian bloke floating around? Was that was a...
Adrian Mazulu? Yeah, we've actually signed him though, but he's actually out on loan. So,
but is it a case?
I'd also just be interested in what the situation is with strikers. I mean, I know we are scoring goals, but Pündav is in fantastic form at Stuttgart, and Timmer's doing quite well, I think, at Rangers. You know, if there are any situations in which they are
season long
back, if we needed to. Yeah.
They are season-long loans. The situation with Pündav is, I believe he has got a clause to buy at the end of the season, but it has to be mutually beneficial for both clubs. So he might want to come back. You never know. But, I mean, we're not going to go too much into it on air.
Look at what's happening here. One, he's German. Two, he's scoring in the Bundesliga. Stuttgart having a stormer. I mean, I think the writing's on the wall here, isn't it?
He's going to be playing in the Euros.
What?
Germany. Well, could happen.
Well,
there are rumours it's going to be in the next squad.
Yeah. Him and Pascal playing for Germany. How about that?
You know, when he's doing so well in Germany, well, in his home, effectively his home country, then, you know, that would be the markers that you're looking at as to see if he's going to come back or not.
But yeah, well, good luck to. I've got a lot of time for Dennis, and I think
absolutely. But just to sign off here, I do harken back to something that Stephen Grant said on the show a good month ago, is that we ought not to get too downhearted by the fact that we haven't actually maintained the high quality that we have from last season. This is a season of consolidation. We're in Europe. We've made it into the second half of the year for the season for Europe. We're still treading water. We're in eighth place. We haven't crashed and burned. We're not relegation fodder, even though our resources should dictate that we are. So by the time that we get those players in that you're talking about, and maybe getting a few more in the summer, next season has the potential to be something pretty amazing. Whether we're in Europe or not is another matter. But this is a club still in transition. The times are so exciting. We're worried about this, this, and this. But in the great scheme of things, we're still way ahead of where we were 3 years ago.
Absolutely. And that's a good place to leave it. So thank you very much, of course, to Alan Wares. Thank you to Jeremy Smith. I've been Aidy Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast, and in association with OldFootballShirts.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all again this week. See you then. Bye.
Happy Jack wasn't old, but he was a man. He lived in the sand at the Isle of Man. The kids would all sing, he would take a wrong key. So they rode on his head in their furry donkey. They try. They drop things on his back. They lie. They couldn't stop Jack or the water's lapping. And they couldn't prevent Jack from
up, Jack, all the water's lapping. Then they couldn't prevent Jack from feeling happy. Jack, they drag, drag, drag. They drop things on his back. The line, 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 line. They couldn't stop Jack, all the water's lapping. And they couldn't prevent Jack from being happy.